You're listening to Adams, Motion, and the Void. Mr. Grave struggled against the pain. It would not abate or even slightly diminish. Although the body had healed and Mr. Grave, through his possession of me, had been rejuvenated, the trade-off, it seemed, was that his body would be forever haunted by the violent fall to the ice. His lungs felt crushed, his bones smashed, his head concussed and fractured. He swallowed hard, doing his best to ignore the thundering, ongoing assault inside his flesh. He relaxed his face and strode with forced ease over the frozen sea until he came within arm's reach of Errol McCluskey. Her momentary terror at finding us untouched by what should have been a deadly fall had been replaced by a seriousness both calm and alert. She was not afraid, and Mr. Grave was still present enough to be disquieted by her reaction. Her green eyes gleamed with life. "Hello, my friend," she said. She reached a cold hand forward, but he slapped it quickly down. "You know why I am here, obviously," Mr. Graves said. "Come inside," she said. "Tea is made. There is a fire. You must be tired and cold. And if you are hurt, we have medicine." She bowed and then turned and began to head back toward the staircase that zippered up the ice cliff. "Painkillers," Mr. Grave requested softly. He hated the weakness of it, but these would be mandatory. He was not thinking straight. He needed composure for the next number of hours.
"Painkillers?" "Yes," Errol confirmed. I recognized, as we began to rise up the stairwell, that a change had come in the prevailing rule of my relationship with him. The wall between us had collapsed. His thoughts and feelings were now fully accessible to me. I felt myself risen up through the cloud and murk of his oppression. I was now close to the skin, on the front lines, as it were. I did not try to control him, however. I needed to conserve such efforts. The station, as we entered, was much as I remembered it. Errol shut and cranked the heavy door behind us, and then set off over the curving catwalk. The air was warm and dull and dry, like old air scrubbed with old brushes and then sent into a foul heater. There was a downward pressure and a feeling of cavernous space. Dim and fuzzy orange bulbs burned into the invisible distance along the concourse. The sheet metal and rebar floor had the nervous feeling of scaffolding, as though everything were dangled from ropes or propped up on weak poles. The combination of darkness and ricketiness, as against the pressurized feeling of the old air, was provocative, as though at any moment the oxygen would deplete, the floor give way, and one would find oneself hurtling through a choking darkness. We passed the downward spill of the stairs as we continued around the catwalk. If I remembered rightly, the stairs led down to the only accessible other level and its series of small barracks. Was this where the children would stay? I wondered. Errol finally angled toward the dark wall and wheeled open a cargo door. We entered the old library, a comfortable but somehow sterile reading room with several large bookshelves, two great mahogany desks, and a scatter of leather chairs. A glimmering rosy light and an acrid scent of smoke confirmed a hidden fireplace. Increasingly discomposed, a hot sweat broke out over Mr. Graves' chest and face. His thoughts were spiraling and colliding. He was losing focus. If he did not put out the fire of his body, he felt he would go mad. "Is there a white pool?" he said, struggling for meaning. "I would like to lay down in the painkiller." A small log fire sparkled in a tucked-away reading nook. Errol lifted the teapot, and an orange glassy curl of liquid poured down into a cup. She extended this kindly. Mr. Graves slapped it from her hand, and the cup shattered on the floor. Errol poured her own cup and sat. Sweat from his brow trickled toward his eye, and he thumbed at the moisture, gritting his teeth, fighting for the word that expressed his need. "Painkiller," he barked finally. Errol opened her hand, and two white pills rolled from her palm onto the table. Mr. Grave had no question about these. He simply pinched his fingers around the white tablets and flung them down his throat before huddling forward over the table to await the removing chill of the anesthetic. A few desperate moments later, there came a wide, warm jab at the entire body. As though to remove the pain, more needed first be added. But quickly there followed a cool, grey washout as all feeling fell flat in a medicated fog. He breathed deeply into the zero state of his numbness, felt his tingling tongue dissolve in a thick lump. Peace came in the form of absence. His body was a soft form with a hard top, plastic and dead. He hated it. His mind stilled and regained its positions. He would give the woman 5 minutes. He would secure the remainder of this anesthetic, and then he would dispatch her. "Are you ready?" Errol asked. "Of course." Mr. Grave heard his words slur and slam together over the thick branch of his tongue. "The station is designed to be operated by 2 people. Errol now glanced at the strange log sculpture on the table center. It had the rough, porous feature of bone or clay. Sticking off its sides here and there were a number of small protrusions, jagged arms and nodules. "As Sherwin remembers, when the ice around Westbrook begins to melt, the station must be released from its locks. When that happens, the main engines will fire. There is no control room here. Everything on the inside of the station will take care of itself. As you know, we expect the ice to break at any time. Tonight, tomorrow, next week. This is Westbrook." Errol shifted the bone-like sculpture into her hands. "A scale model of it, at least," she said. She pushed it across the table to Mr. Grave. He did not touch it. "The entire facility is approximately 4 miles in diameter and 15 miles long. You were under the impression that the Stalwarts commissioned the station. This is not true. We did not make it, Mr. Grave. We did not even make the scale model here. We found the station in 1956, and what we know about it, we've learned from the 100 or so notebooks in this library."
"Well, who wrote the books?"
Mr. Grave slurred. "To the best of our knowledge," Errol said. "You did. You do." She paused for a moment. "You will." Mr. Grave swam back into the anesthetic, into the deep white pool of his bliss. Consciousness shimmered and faded and then returned. Errol continued. "Our learning has been ongoing. We found this only recently." Errol leaned forward, depressing the top of the model, and a thin book slid from its shell. Mr. Grave took this between his unfeeling fingers. He read the title out loud, in his qualityless voice.
"The Technologist and the Hummingbird,"
Mr. Grave slurred. "It describes the role of the 2 operators of the Westbrook Station, the so-called Technologist and Hummingbird," Errol said. Mr. Grave's hard fingers pried the book open. He strained to read the first sentence. "You see these protruding figures along the sides of the model?" Errol leaned forward and tapped at them. "These are the devices, the engines and machines that will keep Westbrook fully functioning once it's set free, providing air, water, etc. But as you will read if you peruse the handbook, the machines will require regular maintenance. The so-called Technologist will be in charge of maintaining these systems and repairing them as required. The Hummingbird will oversee the ongoing life inside the cylinder. There is a small collection of books in this library that will serve as the basis for this oversight. As you may imagine, adjusting to the shift in lifestyles will be a tremendous psychological burden for the children. The Hummingbird is responsible for establishing an environment that will be most conducive to adaptation. The Hummingbird will be the spiritual mother of the internal population."
"I don't see why," Mr. Graves struggled. "One person can't do both of these jobs. Take care of the machines. Take care of the children.
The first stabbing knots of pain were returning, his eyes crossed with a panic, as once more Errol opened her hand to reveal two more pills. They were at the back of his throat without a second thought. He swallowed them tightly and hard and braced for the evacuating relief. And as the white pool opened to take him back into its glacial crucible, and as he regained himself, Errol continued, "The technologist will remain on the outer shell of the station." Mr. Graves stared at her. She was growing thin and bizarre before his narcotically inflamed eyes. His hands were thick and dead on the table, and the long boards of his legs were turning to glue, to wood, to paste, to rubber. Errol looked deeply, penetratingly into his eyes. "Without reprieve, and for the duration," she said, "one of us will be on the inside of the station with the children, and the other one, the technologist, Mr. Grave, you will be on the outside." Errol retrieved the satellite phone from Mr. Graves' zippered snowsuit. She handed it to him with her instruction, "Have your drivers bring the children now." He held the phone in fluffy, feathery hands. He sent the message to his fingers to dial, and he watched absently as the huge ram of his thumb began to hammer away at the small template. His words slurred and blended as the main driver answered,
"Bring your children in now to Westbrook."
15 minutes later, and with some assistance from Errol, we watched with binoculars from the upper balcony as the blue-white headlights of the still far-distant dozen snow cruisers seared like fallen stars in the white frost winds. On the even more distant horizon was a fractured, milky orange spilling of light, as though the sky itself were hemorrhaging against the rough spiking of the sea. We had reports yesterday of an enormous shear off Ellesmere Island, and a number of significant rifts and cracks have been seen in both poles. We expect a rapid acceleration, Errol said. And as she did, a deep earth trembler shook the local world. The air flashed and dazzled over momentarily in a confusion of particles. Errol had, in some secret moment, changed into a thick black foam bodysuit. Hanging back from her neck was a silver glass helmet. The costume was partly that of a skin diver, and partly that of a spacewalker. Mr. Graves stared down the length of his arm, aware of some pressure, and noted that he and Errol had been holding hands. She began to lead him down the stairs. Slung over her shoulder was a very tightly wrapped coil of wire. Mr. Graves' medicated mind
found refuge in the puzzling order of the tight loops of iron. "This is well-wrapped wire," he said in his stupor. At the bottom of the stairs, she continued along the base of the ice wall. With her free hand, she had begun to work the tip of the coil into the metal eyelet at her right hip. Thereupon, she began to feed the wire through the hole and into the foam costume until the spiral had been deployed. She halted beneath a projecting flow of ice, released Mr. Graves' hand, and waved him back. "Stand down 30 or 40 yards," she said. As Mr. Grave took his senseless steps away, Errol locked the helmet into place over her head. Then she pressed in flat against the ice wall, and for a moment there was nothing. Mr. Grave was beginning to feel the first inkling, the very slightest twinge, of his body's returning grief. The word painkiller formed like ash over his tongue, and he spat it out, but far too quietly. He was about to say it again, louder now, when, from a shining point at the back of Errol's foam costume, a black wire darted out in a continuous spool. It shot directly in a line, like a bullet from a gun, but then began to curve against itself and its anchored resistance, until the trajectory line had almost entirely crumpled back, and like a harpoon, the front point of the wire embedded itself in the cliff face, probably 20 yards above the position where Errol stood. She jumped lightly upward, weightless, carried in a pole vaulter's slumbering arc toward the huge ice floe above her. The wire zippered back into the suit, even as it delivered her to her destination. The pain was returning at a worrisome pace. "Painkiller!" Mr. Grave shouted up to her. He was stumbling along the ice, but stopped hatefully when he saw her wave him back. She leaned now toward the icy protrusion, searching its contour, before punching into it sharply with her fist. A dark space appeared where her hand had delivered its blow. She reached into this space, and Mr. Grave recoiled, as with a huge crackling explosion, the overhang began to vibrate and roar. The floe shuddered, and the ice and snow covering it stormed down. A few moments later, Mr. Grave was looking up at a shimmering, glass-black vehicle hovering against the vertical. Errol had managed to get herself inside, and with some awkwardness, was driving it down the wall. As it descended, it chipped free the ice clusters clinging to the sides of the station, revealing the strange, bone-like carapace beneath.
"Painkiller?"
Mr. Grave demanded again. He pounded one fist into the palm of the other. Had she brought any? She must have. There was always the hand opening up and the two white pills rolling forth. He began to move toward her, but stopped as his ear caught the engine sound of the just-arriving caravan of snow cruisers. He turned on his heels and began moving swiftly toward them. He'd almost forgotten. Each cruiser had a complete medical kit, small vials of injectable morphine, even better than the pills. As the pain grew, his movement intensified. The drivers emerged first from the vehicles, dark figures in the snowy distance. The children would be next, but Mr. Grave was not paying any attention to this. His only goal was to get inside the nearest cruiser and then shoot wide its medical kit. The needle, the morphine. Injecting, and then, once again, he would be braced. He would be regained. So preoccupied was he that he did not notice that I had drawn the satellite phone from his pocket and redialed the main driver, issuing the following command.
"An enemy combatant is now running out, told you. Send the children back inside. Have the drivers gather in a line. And when he's in range, fire at will."
Mr. Grave was buried in the nightmare of his body experience. The lungs felt to be suffocating under the pressure of their crushing, the bones splintered, the head pounding with concussion. The urgency of his need created only one picture. The morphine in the small glass vial, the silver kiss of the needle in the small glass vial. The pain was cresting, and he only barely saw the drivers in the distance, pushing the children back into the shuttles. And he made no conclusions as they set into a flanking position and raised their long rifles. He would be there soon. The throbbing, pulsing monster would be subdued, and he would swing back into the blissful nothingness of the white pool. as the bullet spread wide into his chest and body, and their shrapnel flared, and the tiny separating particulate gouged in wide bloody blooms. I already felt the sad satisfaction of the victory, and if I needed to do it again, I would. His pain would build, and the more it built, the less stable he would be. And the less stable he was, the more I might take charge. Mr. Grave tumbled over his legs. Every bullet seemed to enter and re-enter, like hot pokers sliding back and forth in his flesh. We came into stillness. Once again, eyes tossed open on the blue sky, and for the second time that day, lay dying on the ice. We woke in the white pool. There was a lazy fallen halo, a surrounding delicate penumbra of anesthetic. Mr. Graves smiled and sent his gratitude into the bliss of the chemical exclusion. He wanted to see the silvery needle, watch it kiss into his skin. He wanted to hold the glass vials of morphine, count them up, greedy for his treasure. "Can you hear me?" Errol's voice blew like wind through a narrow pipe. Mr. Graves' eyes opened in a swoon. "The children are all safe," she whispered. There was a feeling of acceleration, of propulsion, of the vibratory struggle for speed as she brought him into a sitting position. "The locks were released 3 hours ago. The engines have fired. The station is not yet launched, however, and I'm not sure when it will. But we do have to take up our positions. Do you understand? The time is now." Errol was soon tucking Mr. Graves' insensate body into the black foam costume. His spine was rubber, his head like a hard pillow. A few minutes later, she was opening the door of the Westbrook station. She had obviously seen it already, but Errol paused to let Mr. Grave absorb what had become of the white wasteland. The frozen sea had melted down into a brimming, black-blue ocean. The sky was a wide prairie of red and yellow hills. The air itself was green and glowing. Enormous ice floes swirled madly in the sea, as though screaming against the theft of their flesh. "I've put the notebooks in the vehicle," Errol said. She paused, and they clutched together on the balcony as the station suddenly shifted on its hips and plunged downward into the ocean. There was a deep and furious surge, and the movement went soft and was checked. Mr. Grave teetered in the swarming chaos of his own background, having some trouble remembering he was even there.
"Painkillers," he muttered.
He was bleary, disappearing under the narcotic weight, under the shatter of his fear. Errol came in closer, face to face, looking straight into his eyes. "My eyes." "Time now, Sherwin," she whispered. I mounted myself forward. "Time now," I said. I did not understand, and yet I knew what was meant. I could feel Mr. Grave faltering back, his fingers slipping loose the controls. "I am here now," I said, and Errol smiled and swept toward me. I felt myself spilling wide into Mr. Grave's body, pouring like a liquid metal to fill out the iron cast of his anesthetized flesh. The water around the base of the station went spuming into a fury. We both stared downward through the grate. Even more startling, beneath and beyond the churning white froth of the ocean, we could see the keening yellow rim of blue brightness. The Westbrook engines, firing deep in the earth, were now entering their dynamic. A hot wind seemed to summon downward from the sky, and we both now glanced up, realizing at once that it was not the wind, but the feeling of the floating air as the station climbed into it. "My love always," Errol whispered, and she pressed herself into my body, our lips together in a numb, icy press, before she turned toward the station, brought the door around her, and locked it shut. There was a smallness to all that happened next, an up-closeness. My fingers and hands set right before my eyes. I pulled on the helmet, affixed the small clasps. I fired the zither and watched the coil sing out into space, and then dive back toward the bony carapace. I went swinging out into the air, but still, it was the small world feeling. I did not notice myself flying through space, attached to the wire, but instead, it was the experience of my breath, huffing inside the helmet, that I watched and felt. The wide, cold sensation of my numb body. I fired the coil again and was dragged along through the slippery vortex, and a moment later, I was slowly pushing my body into the window of the black glass vehicle. I rolled up into the single seat, and in this pattern of slowest motion, I affixed the straps that would hold me to it. Thus the station lifted and bent in its arc and passed out through the atmosphere. But I myself saw none of it, only my hands, my fingers, my breath against the glass of the helmet, the numbness of my skin, looking not at the planet disappearing beneath me, but at the shimmering glass all around, its black opal shine and my reflection in it, staring at my shadowy self then, as the small white stars began to bleed their brightening tips in sharper circuits all around.
Thank you.
I will write more of this, or maybe not. I had thought these notebooks would be full, but I found them empty, and so fill them up in whatever way I like. There are other parts to tell, things I forgot. The stories I have told are the stories you will tell, and the stories you tell are the ones I write down now from memory. Each is based on each, from back to front and front to back. They are each other's original proof. The specifics are not in themselves valuable. There is only where we point at with our story, and that is always simple and always true. We point at life. We point to love. I put the notebook down. My legs were stiff and my back ached. No more so than usual. The lungs, of course, a joke now to me, with their weary illusion of collapse, and the bones, each one, feeling snapped into dust. No matter to me. I have long since learned to concentrate elsewhere. The pain exists, but not for me. I watch it like I might have long ago watched the sun burning into the morning. But Mr. Grave, in his deep despairing well, has a different relation to it. Looking at the sun, he believes he is the sun, and so he burns like the sun. And who can say how long I might manage, or whether he might return, or what balance may need to be struck? There is no such thing as just me, or just him. We are both here, and who can judge the value of actions in opposition? I stood out free from the vehicle. I might drive it here or there, sleep in it, rest. Repairs were needed at the place I called the Baptist intake. A small, flickering part was jammed. It could stay like that for several years, and nothing would come of it. Eventually catastrophic, but insignificant from the moment to moment. Later I would lay myself down beside the malfunction and record my impression of the problem and my solution in one of the technical notebooks I keep. I walked out over Westbrook, legs stiff, back aching. I felt beneath me the pulsing of its inhabitants. How many times had they doubled? How many years had passed? I could picture nothing of reality as they had it inside. But sometimes, at my leisure, and for no reason, I will find myself laying out against the Westbrook station door, my feet propped along the old balcony floor, wishing there was some way, if only for a moment, that I might open it and enter, to walk along the old catwalk, to tap Errol's shoulder, to see those old green eyes. It is of course true that I miss her, but I would miss her if she was standing here beside me. The distance is not surmountable. There is no such thing as touching. But the warmth that I have, and the safety that I have, and the joy that I may experience, all comes without effort. To keep them warm, to keep them safe, in the way that I can, to keep the machines working, doing whatever it is they do, making it possible moment by moment. It is not a sacrifice. It is not a job or duty, not an obligation. It is just obvious. It is clear. When the engine breaks, I go to it, just as every evening or morning or afternoon, or timeless time that it is, I will sit down and open my notebook to tell you some part of this story, so that you may remember, so that I may remember, and remember again and again. Bright stars in the milky shimmer, almost all white now around us in the clustered gathering of stars, the white pillowing light, weightless, mounting, striving, all slowly hustling toward the original point of state that does nothing from a point of everywhere, and everything from a point of nowhere. It would be a while yet, or it would be no time. Until then, I was walking over Westbrook, fixing the engines, sitting down to write these stories and notes. But of course, at some point, one will have to put the notebook down, as there will be nothing left to write, and one may be free to simply go out over the long white landscape of the new world, to move along as slowly as one likes. To be simple and clear, and just go walking out over whatever there is left of the world.
been listening to atoms, motion, and the void. Thank you.